Good morning. My name is Linda Murphy, and I am a very active member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon and Alateen. My home group is the Step by Step. We meet on Monday and Friday evenings at 6 o'clock in Bowling Green. So if you're ever in our neighborhood, stop by and join us for a meeting. I want to thank Milton for inviting us down this weekend. This is just such a peaceful serenity place, and it's a very intimate conference, and we are really enjoying it. I enjoyed Brenda last night. When I woke up this morning, I thought for a moment, oh, wouldn't it be fun to drive a big truck? I drove a tractor when I was growing up, but I never drove a big truck. That might be a plan. There's a couple of things I want to share about myself first. My husband and I, we just celebrated 27 years of marriage in January, and that within itself is an absolute miracle, and I give all the credit to Al-Anon and AA. Between us, we have 6 children. They are all married. That gives us 12 adult children, and we have 15 grandchildren. And life for us today is grand. We have a good time today. And that, again, is a miracle. I am very involved in service. And, you know, one of those ha-ha moments, we just got back from my third World Service Conference. And the first trip we got to do was go to Stepping Stones, Bill and Lois Wilson's home. And we got to the New York airport, and there were a couple of other delegates that were leaving before us, so they had to be there earlier, and we were scheduled to fly out at like 5:20 in the afternoon. And we had major layovers, and we finally left that airport at 10:10 on Sunday night. And, you know, the beauty of that was there was this one alcoholic trapped with like 22 Al-Anons. And we had this wonderful meeting right in the middle of the airport on patients, and then we had a sharing session, and it was a grand time. It was a bonding time, and I thought, where but in this program? And it was absolutely wonderful. I'm going to start by sharing just a little bit about me. I grew up in a very structured, protected, religious home. My father did not like change, and my mother did not like chaos. And I thought all families grew up that way. I had one older brother, and I have 2 younger sisters. And our perception of what our childhood was looks different to each one of us. But for me, my childhood, I cannot think of one thing that I would go back and change in that. My parents gave us wonderful tools to live by, wonderful morals, and I still practice those in my life today. When I was in, I remember moving one time when I was growing up, and I was about 12 years old. And we lived there until the time I left home. And so I went to school with a lot of the same kids. We went to college together. Everything in my life was consistent. So I took on that characteristic of everything being consistent all through my high school, college, and adult life. And, you know, later discovered that I don't like change either. When I was in high school, I guess this is one of those warning signals I should have noticed, but I didn't know what I was looking at. My teachers created a special award for me when I was a senior in high school. We had the awards day. And, you know, this was brought back up to me a few months ago when I was cleaning out some old things that you keep and everything. And they had created an award just for me for that awards day. And it was the Miss Maxwell House Award. And I was very surprised by that, but I thought it was the grandest thing that had ever happened. I was so proud. And what it actually said was, this young lady kept the teacher's lounge in tip-top shape. She washed our mugs. She had the coffee made. It was always fresh. And that lounge was neat as a pin. People pleaser, what do you think? So anyway, after graduation, I went off to college. And that is not something I wanted to do, but it was something that was very important to my father. So, and it was while I was in college that I met my first husband. When we were talking about getting married, I had a lot of people who said, oh, you don't want to do that. My first husband was several years older than I was. And, but you know, when you're that young and your mindset, you're going to do what you want to do anyway. So I did it, and I can truthfully stand before you and say the second day of that marriage, I knew I'd made a mistake. I wished I could just go back and redo it all. But, you know, once you make a commitment to do something, you rode it through to the very end. I was not a quitter because that's the way I was raised. But I was in that marriage for 11 years, and it took me 3 to get out of that marriage. And I made that deal with God. If you will just get me out of this, I will never do this again. And then I met him. When I left that marriage, I had a new home, and I had 2 little girls, and I had a job that I just loved. And I knew I was going to be okay. Now, I grew up with a God. I grew up with a loving God. We were always in church, and, you know, that was a big thing with our family. And I always knew that God loved me and was looking out for me. But now the journey that I took later in life, it wasn't the fact that God left me. It's the fact that I left God because he wasn't working fast enough and he just wasn't doing things my way. And I just knew how this picture needed to shape up. So anyway, I met the alcoholic. And now I used to say he qualified me for this program. But what I have found out in my journey in Al-Anon, I qualified for this program long before I got here. He just happened to be the one that I tagged with it for many years. He became a patient in the office where I worked. I worked in a dental office, and he became a patient in our office. And we had that instant magnetic bonding. And we spent many, many weeks, many months just talking. He would come in, and we'd talk and just really got to know each other. And before long, we were going to dinner and to the movies, and before long, he was moving in. And that was not the way that I was raised. And I always said it wasn't as much as what my parents said about it as the things that they did not say about it. And that was a real uncomfortable thing for me. But we did the back and forth thing for a long time. And, you know, I've heard other people in the program talk about being on that merry-go-round. We weren't on a merry-go-round. We were on a roller coaster. And it really got faster as we spent more time together. But when we first started out, it was a lot of fun. And I need to say, we had fun. We did fun things together. We laughed a lot together. But there was something over a period of time that began to change in that. When he moved into my home, he came with a clothes basket. And everything he brought with him fit in that clothes basket. And it would sit by the dresser. Now, when the clothes basket was there, he was there. When it was gone, he was gone. And I never knew when he was going to come and when he was going to go. Now, for a while, that did not bother me. I didn't have anxiety about it. I didn't have thoughts about it. I didn't try to find out where he was, why he was. He just was. So, you know, over a period of time, though, that began to change. That I was beginning to feel feelings that were not normal for me. You know, there was that anxiety, there was that frustration, there was a lot of fear becoming, there was a lot of jealousy developing, and I did not like those feelings that were developing inside of me. And I never knew how long the in was going to be or how long the out was going to be. But there was one particular afternoon, and there was an incident, and something inside of me snapped. And I am the one who became physical. And I remember I was so angry, I was so mad, I was so violent, I was so physical, that once the incident was over, I was terribly embarrassed and ashamed. But I remember he set me down, or he was sitting on top of me, and he said, if you don't stop, you're going to get hurt. And I mean, I was mad. I mean, it's like all that stuff that had been suppressed, pushed down, ignored, it just... the lid just flew off, and I flew out. So I remember when I was leaving that, I had such shame and such embarrassment, I just could not believe that I had acted in such a way. And at that moment, I thought, you know, I can't do this anymore. So I don't know how much time elapsed, but anyway, I told him, I said, you know, I don't want to do this anymore. I want you to leave. So he took his clothes basket and he left. I don't remember how long that we were apart, but I intuitively knew I needed to keep the head and the heart together because I knew he was going to call. He always called. He would give me time to miss him. You know how the alcoholics do. You give you time to miss, you think about it, and you call, and you say those nice fuzzy things, and you get sucked right back in. But I knew if I could just keep the head and the heart together, you know, I could do this. And there was that one afternoon, you know, the mist was really setting in, and the head and heart were not lined up together, and he called, and he said, I miss you. And so we're talking for a few moments, and he said, you know, he said, we just really need to go get married. Well, that's what we did. You know, we didn't have any communication skills. We didn't know how to do a relationship. We were in, we were out, and that just sounded like the thing to do. So we went and got married. So on our way back from getting married, he said, you know, we really need to go someplace where nobody knows us and we can start all over, just you and I. Well, that sounded like a plan. I had no problem with that. But he was a construction worker, so he could go anywhere and get a job. So that was his mission. He was going to look for a job. He was he worked in construction. So he heads out toward Texas, and he gets his job at a nuclear powerhouse in Texas. So he calls me, and he said he's got a job. So now what we're going to do is we're going to load up his 32-foot travel trailer, and we're going to move to Texas. Well, for right then, that sounded okay. That sounded like a plan. So what I had to do was get my house empty, and I had a 3-bedroom home at this time, very comfortable in my 3-bedroom home. And we were going to sort through this stuff and load up this little home on wheels, and we're going to Texas. Now, where he is going to take us, he told me it was paradise. We are going to love it. The kids are going to have such an experience. And I just said, okay. So he gets there, and I have all my goodies together that we're going to put in this little travel trailer. And he's informing me, I cannot take my maple dinette set. I cannot take all those toys and all those clothes because they're not going to fit. So we had to redo, and, you know, that kind of hurt my feelings that I couldn't take my stuff. So we're loaded up, and we're getting ready to leave, and I remember it was late March, and we were getting ready to leave, and it was cold, and it was snowing, and I got in that truck with him, and just for a brief moment, this little voice deep down inside said, "What are you doing?" And I took a deep breath, and off we went. So all the way to Texas, he's telling me about Surfside Beach, Texas. What an adventure it's going to be, how much the girls are going to enjoy it. They are going to just love it. You have never seen any place for beautiful. Not so much. We get there, and it's right in the middle of Surfside Beach, Texas. And the hurricane had been there a few years before we did, so there was nothing there. There was no trees, there was no mailbox, there was no telephones, there were no people. But we were right in the middle of this beach. So you look out, and all you can see is water. And you look around, and all you can see is sand. Now, for the first week, it might have been okay. After that, it got to be way too much. Because by this time, we had a small son, and we had my two daughters. And you would have to let the table down at night to put the playpen up for him to sleep. You pull out our bed, and it's on an incline because of the way it fit in the little home on wheels. The girls were upstairs in an overhang. You constantly had to sweep the sand out of the bed, off the table, off of everything. That got old really quick. Now, I'm not an Al-Anon. I've had no knowledge of Al-Anon to this point. And he's going to meetings, and he is not a happy camper either. And everything is my fault. It's all my fault. And I'm believing this. I'm thinking, okay, what is it I need to do? What can I do different? How do I need to act different? Maybe I don't need to complain so much, but it was all my fault. Now, he would go to a meeting, and he'd go angry. He'd come home angrier. And I'm there, you know, and I'm just there. So we had done that probably for about 4 or 5 months. And I'm thinking, whew, all I need to do is just go home. You know, this is not what I wanted to do or what I signed up for. But we had gotten to the place to where we were barely talking. And when we did, it was very angry. There were a lot of accusations, and it was very uncomfortable. And a friend of ours from Bowling Green, I had gone to open AA meetings with him in Bowling Green, and I tell you what, you alcoholics are fun people. You are fun. And I'd hung out with some of these alcoholics with him, and they were just grand. And this one particular guy, his name was John, and he showed up at our little home on wheels. And how he found us, I have no idea. And to this day, I do not know how John found us, because we are in the middle of nowhere. We don't have a mailing address. We had never given anybody directions, because I wouldn't know how to direct you in the first place. So I asked him, I said, how did you find us? And he said, I'm a messenger from God. That's the first miracle of God doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. He had mentioned the talk a couple of times of going to treatment, because he knew he was kind of like in a dangerous place too. And these are things that had been developing and escalating over a period of time, so it wasn't something that just happened. So John stayed for about 4 days, and he slept in his car because there wasn't any room in the little home on wheels. And they would walk the beach, and they would talk, and you know, I'm just there. So by the time John left, he decided he was going to go to treatment. Now, he'll probably share that in his story tonight, and this is my version and my perception of what happened. So tonight when you hear him talk, you're going to think, they weren't even in the same relationship. So he's decided he's going to treatment. So what I needed to do was, he was going to do the thing with his job, and I needed to call the treatment center to get pre-approval with his insurance, call the airline, get airline tickets for him to fly out, and get things ready, because the kids and I were going back home. And I started on that instantly, because I didn't want enough time to pass where he could change his mind. So the quicker I got it in action, the quicker it was going to happen. So we were getting ready to go, and I was so excited that I was getting to go back home. I was going to be with my family. I had never been that far away from my family in my whole life. And when I would talk to my parents, I would engage them in the craziness that was going on in our home. And there's a gift in that when I get over in a few minutes. But anyway, they wanted us to come home too, because they did not care for this man that I had married. They didn't have that instant like with him the first time they met him. He was doing too many changes with his daughter, and they didn't trust him, and we were way out with their grandchildren. So they were glad we were coming home. And I got to spend 30 days of just R&R. My mother helped take care of the grandchildren, and I was there, and I didn't have to deal with all that chaos and everything. And he was in treatment, and things weren't going so hot for him, but, you know, that's his story. So during all this time, there were a couple of the members of the AA group that would call to my parents' house and check on me, and they would say, this is the perfect time for you to get into Al-Anon. Well, I didn't know what Al-Anon was. I had never heard Al-Anon. No one had ever explained Al-Anon to me. So I had no clue what that was. But I knew between being home, being with my family, and getting back in their church, I was going to be okay. So the month's going quickly, and it's getting close to time that I'm going to have to make plans to go pick him up for the airport. Now, that negative committee goes into meeting, and you know how it goes. You start that scenario, and what you're going to do, and what you're going to say, and how it's going to work out. And that's what we did for several days. The negative committee and I had a plan in mind. And I had this, not a lecture, I just had this opinion I was going to share with him. But my main thing was, I wasn't going back to Texas. I was done. I was so done. So he gets off the airport, and he looks calm, relaxed, good, happy. I'm thinking, And the first thing he says is, let's go have lunch before we start back home. So we did, and then he starts sharing the things that he had learned in treatment. Things he needed to do different, changed attitudes, things he was going to try. And he said, we really need to go back to Texas and try it one more time. I think we can make it. I think we can do things different. And he said, and I need you. Negative committee was dismissed, no scenario, off to Texas we're going. So we spent a short period of time at home visiting family, getting the kids ready, and we're going back to Texas. So when we're loading up and we're getting ready to go, I only had one request. If I go back to Texas, I don't want to go back to Surfside Beach. He said, no problem. We'll move into town. That was the fix for everything. We're going into civilization. So we're going back to Texas, and we move into this, I call it a construction workers commune. Everybody there is living in a little home on wheels. They're all working construction. They have kids there. So my kids are going to have kids to play with. I'm in walking distance of stuff. It's going to be great. So we did that for a few months, and for a period of time, it was okay. The new was still there, and we were doing different things. He was going to meetings. I was not. I'm still not in Al-Anon. But things were beginning to change. We were going back to the way we were. And I had developed the skill of silent treatment. Today I know that is not a good quality to have, but I learned it very well. I could go a day, a week, or a month and never speak to him. And that's really hard on a relationship, because when you do that, you kind of have to rebuild the territory where you were. Well, in my mind, I thought our problems was because we were living in this little home on wheels. Now, what we actually need to do is move into an apartment, something, especially if we're going to be here for a while. So being the good alcoholic, he's playing that mind game with me, and he puts this huge price on this travel trailer. Well, I didn't know that it was a big price, and he thought, she'll never get it. So he walked out the door to go to work. I put a for sale sign in the window, and I sold it, just like that. So he got home, and I said, I have sold the little home on wheels. We need to go get an apartment. He couldn't believe I had sold that. We have ways. We know how to get it done. So anyway, we move into this apartment, and it was huge. It looked like a castle compared to what we were living in. And I thought, this is going to be it. We've got spread out room. We've got breathing room. It looks like a home. So we lived there for, I don't know, the whole rest of the time that we were in Texas. That's the apartment that we lived in. And for a very brief moment, things were okay, but we went back to the way we were. And I still wasn't in Al-Anon. I was going to open AA meetings with him in Texas where we lived, and I would see this group of women come in, and this one in particular, she was always so cheery, so bright, so happy. And she would always walk over to me, and she'd pat me on the back, and she'd say, we've got a meeting for you. And I would just ignore it. And she would leave me some literature, you know, and we'd leave. But I'm still not doing Al-Anon. And I remember there was one morning I woke up, and the very first thing I thought about was go to an Al-Anon meeting, because things were not good. And when I went to that Al-Anon meeting, I think what I wanted them to tell me was, you don't have to do this anymore. You know, you don't have to do this. But what they told me was, keep coming back. And what I heard in those rooms were a lot of hope. Now, when I am the second wife in the family of this alcoholic, and when I'm attending these Al-Anon meetings, they are all older ladies. And they had been with their alcoholic through the whole do. So I felt like I did not belong, because I am the second wife to this alcoholic. And when I met him, he was 4 years and 5 months sober. And you think, what's the problem? So in one of our books, in our How Al-Anon Works, the book How Al-Anon Works, it makes a statement. I did not know the alcoholic when he was actively drinking, but I am affected by his every mood. Could this be alcoholism? Well, I didn't know, because I didn't really know what alcoholism was about. And then there's another statement that says, the changes within me happened so slowly, and so subtly, I did not even know it was happening. And that's what happened to me. And he had told me early in our relationship, he said, I need to tell you, I am a recovering alcoholic. And I thought, minor detail. I'll take care of that. I was good at taking care of things and fixing things, so I'll fix that. But I didn't know what that was. I had no understanding. So anyway, I'm going to these Al-Anon meetings now, and I'm setting. But I'm not sharing. I'm not letting you know anything about me because my husband is sober and I am crazy. I listened, and I would get there as soon as that meeting would start, not too many moments before, and as soon as they said amen, I was out that door. But the things that I was hearing in that meeting were beginning to take a place in my heart. And I went to a speaker meeting one night, and this lady was actually sharing my story. She was the second wife of. They had his kids, her kids, their kids. They were from someplace else. It was just my story. And that's when the seed was planted. I made my very first Al-Anon meeting in July of 1984. I do not remember the very date, the very meeting. I'm so proud of you all that can do that. It was all I could do to write that date in my book. So this July, I will have 27 years in Al-Anon, and I tell you what, the journey has just been amazing. It is so many, it's filled with so many miracles. So I'm making these meetings, and but your laughter, that just drove me crazy because I hurt so bad deep in my heart. So I thought, okay, I'm going to go to the other side of town, because at that time where we lived in Texas, you could go to meetings morning, noon, and night. You had all kinds of meetings to choose from. And you could go to a different meeting every day of the week and never go to the same meeting, sometimes not see the same people. So I went across town thinking it was going to be a little bit different. And it wasn't. That laughter and all that stuff was there too. And I don't know how I got past that, except I remember I would just go and I would sit. And all I could do was cry, but there was hope. There was hope, and you kept telling me, it's going to get better. Keep coming back. Keep coming back. Well, what I heard in those meetings were the steps, traditions, and the slogans, and sponsorship. I knew nothing about any of that. And when I would read those steps on the wall, you know how you read them and you check them off, you know? I knew a God. I made amends all the time. I'm always saying I'm sorry, so I'm making amends all the time, you know, and I'm sharing with others. I'm always telling you what's going on, so I'm always sharing what's going on. So, but I heard that sponsorship is the key to uncover, and I didn't know what to do with that. So we had a pamphlet, what sponsorship is all about. So I started praying for this sponsor, that God would lead me to the person that I needed for a sponsor. And I can truthfully say that this person, you know, I think her joy and everything just overwhelmed me. So we became face-to-face one day after a meeting, and instantly I said, would you be my sponsor? And then I thought, oh my gosh, what have I done? You know, and she said yes. So we started that journey of sponsorship and working those steps and working those traditions together, and what a gift. And what I discovered from that was everything that she was is exactly what I wanted to be. I wanted to be happy, joyous, and free. I wanted to be present in my own life, and those are the things that she gave to me. We went through those steps, and there was so much healing. We had been there about 2 years, and my husband came home one afternoon, and he said, pack up, we're moving back to Bowling Green. Well, when we went there, I wasn't crazy about going, and now I'm not crazy about leaving because I had found serenity. I found exactly where I needed to be, and she was my life raft. And so we did. We packed up, and we moved back to Bowling Green, and we had a time of sharing, and she said, you know, just get you an Al-Anon meeting when you get back to Bowling Green. And if they're talking about the steps and traditions, you're in an Al-Anon meeting. So I would start going to meetings in Bowling Green, and I'd get home from the meetings, and I would call her, and I'd say, oh, they don't know how to do the meetings in Bowling Green because I'm so used to the way they were doing them in Texas. And she would just laugh at me, and she'd say, are they doing the steps and traditions, you know? And she said, you're in a meeting. And today when I go to different places, I think, that's not the way we do it in Bowling Green. But you know what? It's okay, because I know when I'm in an Al-Anon meeting. Over a period of years, I still called her because that is where my serenity was, and she knew all about me, and she knew all about the situation and everything, and I would call her. Sometimes I'd call her 3 and 4 times a week. When it was good stuff, I'd call her. When it was bad stuff, I'd call her, and she'd talk me through all of it. And there was one time when I called her, and I knew she loved me, and I knew she had my best interest at heart. And she said, you know, she said, you've been gone long enough now that you need a sponsor that you can see, that you can sit face to face with. And I was grounded enough in my recovery that I did not take that as rejection. I took it as she was helping me to grow in my recovery. And I did get a sponsor in my hometown, but I still have her. I can call her anytime. And she always said, get out of your comfort zone. Get busy. You know, we have a book that says, when I got busy, I got better. And so a few years passed, and I got into service work quite by accident on my part, but God's perfect timing on his part. And that was 1986, and I have been involved in service work every time. And every time I go to something like this, I think, what a gift, because my recovery family has just gotten a little bit bigger. You know, it's just grown, and what a blessing that is. So in my journey in Al-Anon, we've had some tough spots, and we've had some absolute miracles. And one of the things was that I knew I didn't cause it, I can't control it, and I can't cure it. And I knew I had to change the focus on the alcoholic, because my days began and end with what he was or what he was not doing or how he was. And through the steps of this program, the miracles of sponsorship and everything, we're able to give each other their individuality, and we don't have to change each other today. In 2004, I lost both of my parents within 5 months of each other. And they would have been married 56 years that December if they both had lived. 15 years into the program, some truths about my childhood started developing. And I found out quite by accident that both of my parents were adult children of alcoholics. And they had kept that a secret all of our years growing up. And it tells us in the program we're as sick as the secrets we keep. And I remember the embarrassment and the shame of my mother when I found that out. She was going through cancer treatment, and I was taking my grandmother to see her. And my grandmother started talking about my grandfather. And I had spent lots of times with my grandparents because they were a very active part of our lives when we were growing up. And I would hear her talk about this fear that my mother had, and how they would hide under the staircases, and how my grandfather would come in rip-roaring drunk. I never saw my grandfather like that. I just could not think who she's talking about. So that was an awakening for me. So after a few weeks, I began to gently open that box with my mother. And like I said, she had a lot of shame and embarrassment. She got very angry with my grandmother because how dare her tell that? There was no need for us to ever know that. And I tried to reassure my mother, that is a tapestry of my life that gives me a look at why I'm like I am. So we started sharing. When she would go to do chemo treatments or anything, I was the child, the daughter that always took her. And I would sit there with her, and we would start talking. And I'd thank this program for the gift of listening, not only with the ears, but also with the heart. And I could listen to my mother share things that she had kept locked up all her life. And I could just see her, just all that stuff just dropping off of her, where she didn't have that shame and that embarrassment anymore. And that was giving her the gift of program in a way that she may not have ever got it. Now, I also found out that my father was, in talking with her, she filled in some of the blanks with my father. At 12 years old, he was put out on the streets to take care of himself because his parents could not take care of him. And that's why my father had to have consistency, and he had to have structure, and he didn't like change, because nothing in his life was ever consistent and everything was always changing. And he wanted more than that for his children. And that's why my mother didn't like chaos. She liked everything warm and fuzzy and happy. If everybody's happy, she's happy. But she didn't have that growing up as a child, and they wanted their children to have so much more than that. So we carried on the isms of the indirect drinking, which I carried on into the relationship with the alcoholic that I met. That's why we mesh so well. You know, it is just, So anyway, in December of 2003, we have a son that we had together. And he was always called the boy toy. And the older kids, they just thought he was just it. And he was a good kid. He's still a good kid. But he is not the one that we ever thought would have the drinking problem. Never thought about it, because he started in Al-Anon and AA when he was 2 weeks old. He would go to meetings, and by the time he was three, he could have chaired his own meeting. He knew the format of the whole meeting. And he excelled in everything. He was a good student. He had lots of friends. He was good at sports. And by the time he was a junior in high school, there were several colleges that were pursuing him to come to college and play football. Now, we go to a lot of conferences, and there were two in particular where there were some young guys sharing their story. And they talked about how they'd got a scholarship for either basketball or baseball, and they had to make that decision, either the sports or the drinking, you know. And I remember he looked at me and he said, "I sure hope that doesn't happen to our son." And I said, "Me too." But it wasn't long before we were going right down that path with him. Now, there were some things that I should have clued into, but, you know, I had other people saying, "Don't worry about him. He's going to be fine. As soon as he goes to college, he's going to be okay. This is just that senior stuff." You know, and I think sometimes we want to believe what we want to believe. So he went off to college, and I think there's an agenda there that I may never, ever know about. But the second semester, he lost a big chunk of his scholarship, and by the time he was going back for his third semester, it's like, "Please don't go off and leave me here, because I'm not staying." And we did not realize how deep into drugs and alcohol he actually was. So his plan was to come back home and go to the university there in Bowling Green, Western Kentucky University. And I really didn't care as long as he went to school, and, you know, that was going to be okay. So he got enrolled, and the days he was leaving, I assumed he was going to class. Well, he was not going to class, and he called me at work the day of finals, and he said, "I just need to tell you what I've done." And I thought maybe he aced a class or something. And he said, "I have just withdrawn from all of my classes." Now, this is the day of finals. And I'm thinking, "Why did you do that?" And he said, "I didn't want to mess up my GPA. So anyway, that was the end of his college career. So he has all this free time on his hands now. And we never knew when he was coming and when he was going, what his activity was. But I knew that I was beginning to get to the place where I did not feel safe with him being in our home. And I was beginning to find a lot of stuff, and we had to make some decisions. So I guess it was when I found some weed and some baggies under his bed the first time. I told him, I said, "You can't live here and practice that kind of behavior." And I said, "You're going to have to leave." And he was like 20 years old at that time. And he said, "Okay, no problem." He didn't say, "Well, where am I going to go?" or anything, but they always find a place to go, and he did. And his disease just absolutely spiraled. On December the 26th, 2003, he started preparing for New Year's Eve. And by preparing, I mean he was drinking. He was drinking hard and heavy. And we always told him, "If you ever get picked up for drunken driving, don't call home, because we're not going to pick you up." So on January the 2nd, we get a phone call from the Warren County Jail. He has arrived. And so I answer the phone, and of course they give you that cute little message, and I just hung up the phone, and he calls back, and I know it's him because it's immediate, so I hang up again. So I pick up the third time, and there's this voice screaming on the other end of the line, "Tell him it's his son." And we knew it was him. So I handed the phone to his dad, and he talked to him for a few minutes, and I heard him say, "No, we're not coming to bail you out. No, you got yourself in there. You can get yourself out." And he hung up the phone. We did a high five, went back to bed. For the first time in months, I knew exactly where he was. And I used to say he stayed in jail for 12 days, but he's corrected me, and he actually said it was 14 days. But during those nights, I absolutely slept so peaceful because I knew where he was. There was, you know, ambulances and everything that would pass up and down our street. You know, I would just say to myself, "God, I hope that's not him," and I'd try to let it go. So at day 14, the jail called and said, "You can come get the boy out of jail." And I had a grandson that was going to be born on January the 14th. I mean, we knew that was the day, and so my mother was still living, and we had made plans to go up there with my daughter and be there when my grandson was born. So I told this lady, I said, "Well, I'm leaving to go be with my daughter. She's delivering today, and I can't come right now." So there was this long silence, and she said, "What time do you think you'll be here?" And I said, "I should be back in town about 6 or 6:30. There was another long silence, and she said, "We're open 24 hours. And that was the end of conversation. So when I got back to Bowling Green, I went and picked up his dad, and we went down to the jail, and we picked him up, and we took him home. And for a brief time, there was some remorse. He was very sad that he had missed the birth of his nephew. He was very upset over his behavior and being in jail and all that stuff. But you know, that didn't last very long. A good night's sleep, and he's out doing it again. So some time went by, and his car, I guess, was impounded, confiscated, whatever you want to call it, because there was a lot of stuff that was in his car that didn't need to be there. And he was facing some serious jail time, and we didn't know how serious. But the thing that progressed on through that was he was going to need an attorney. And we had kind of talked and decided that was a road that we weren't willing to go down. So I think his dad went with him to talk to one attorney, and the fee was astronomical, and he ended up getting a court-appointed attorney. And when he was in jail, I went to see him one time, and I told him, I said, "You know, I love you, but I am not coming back to visit you in jail because I'm not going to talk to you through a window." And he said, "I understand," and I didn't go back. Now, I could not have done that on my own self-will. I had program, I had sponsor, and I had a God that had my back on that. And I learned in these programs I had to say what I mean and mean what I say, and that's what I did. So he was going to court. It seemed like he was in court forever. And his attorney would call, and she'd say, "You know, he's going to be in court this particular day, and one of you all need to be there," because we had not been going to the court proceedings. But she said, "One of you all need to be there today." So I call my sponsor, and I tell her what's coming up, and she'd say, "Just, you know, take God with you. Try to remain calm, you know, don't let your emotions show. If you're going to fall apart after you leave." And I'd say, "Okay." So I got to the courthouse, and of course they bring him in, all the other little guys in their little orange jumpsuits, and he's in handcuffs and shackles, and I tell you what, that absolutely broke my heart. But I had to do the serenity prayer. I just sat there and did the serenity prayer. So I listened to all the court proceedings, and his attorney said, "Do you want to say anything to him?" So I had like 30 seconds. And I couldn't think of anything to say to him, but I went down and I hugged him and I said, "You know, orange was always one of your best colors. Keep the humor in it." And he still remembers that. But if I had broke down and cried, you know, I don't know. I don't know what that picture would have looked like, but I remember she say, "Hold on to the humor, fall apart when you leave." And that's what I did. I cried all the way home. I called my sponsor. She talked me through it, and it was okay. So as we're progressing on to this, he is getting ready for sentencing. And we have already been told he's looking at 10 years in prison. And, you know, again, the serenity prayer, have to let go. Sponsor said, let him be responsible for the consequences of his actions. She would say, stay out from between him and God. You could cost him his life. So, you know, we went through that journey, and just by a miracle, he got 5 years probation and not 10 years in prison. He has now served his 5 years in probation. And along with that, he was court-appointed to AA meetings. He had to go live in a halfway house because he could not come back home and live with us. He had to be under supervision. And those were valuable lessons for him. And there was an incident in one of the treatment centers, and one of the advocates for the courts called and said, you know, he's not in a safe place, and I'm going to see if the judge will let him come back and live at home. But he had really, really strict curfews and things that he had to adhere to. And one more time, pushed the bar, and I said, you know what? I'm not going to be responsible for your mess-ups. You're going to have to leave. So he talked to whoever it was, and he moved in with some buddies, and he had a job. And his boss or the people at his work thought, how can they let that kid sit in jail? And so I think they were trying to figure some way out to get him out of jail, and of course it didn't work. And it was a couple years later where his boss showed up at an Al-Anon meeting, and I didn't have to say a thing. He looked at me, and I looked at him. He said, now I understand, because they have a son that went through alcoholism also. We have a good time today. We do a lot of fun things together today. And, you know, I think about my journey in Al-Anon. I thought, you know, if I can just get out of this and just start over, I'll be okay. But I am so grateful for strong sponsorship and strong messages in this room and the message of hope that says, don't give up 5 minutes before the miracle. Because we did that journey. We had a lot of tug of wars, a lot of give and take. And I can truthfully say, I so enjoy where we are today. Now, is that to say that every day is great and that we never have any disagreements? Nope, because we can get in some powerhouse situations. But today, I have tools on how to do that. I don't have to start the war. You know, sometimes we can agree to disagree, or I can just walk away and we'll come back and we'll readdress that. One of the biggest things I wanted from this program when we were early in our program is I wanted all those kids to get along. I wanted them to be like brothers and sisters because we were a blended family. And that was my first big agenda with my sponsor. I would talk to her and I said, I don't know what to do with this. You know, I get this bunch setting out and this bunch starts up. And she'd say, why don't we do something real simple like just let go and let God? Well, that never dawned on me. So she said, when those personalities start, just back off and let them take care of it. And that's what I did. And they are the amazing bunch of kids you'll ever meet. They love each other. They're just like brothers and sisters. When there's graduations, babies, weddings, whatever, they're all there. Between them, they get together and they plan events where they all can be there. And they invite us because they want to be with each other. And these grandkids, they don't know any other life besides with their Mimi and their grandpa. And for that, I am so grateful because and it's all because of what we've learned in these rooms. There's a reading in our Courage to Change that says, today, I know that I'm passionate, I'm generous, I'm caring, I'm moody, I'm opinionated, but the only person that I really can take care of is myself. And I didn't always know that. And it tells me that those days I get up and I'm really into my opinionated mood or I'm really into a moody place, that's okay for today because I have tools that will get me out of that. I have sponsorship. I have a meeting. I have a God that I can hit my knees and pray for. So what I have gotten from these rooms, I will never, ever be able to repay. and I hope that I have shared the message of hope with someone here today. Thank you.